right, good morning. Let's pick up in Esther chapter 7 this morning. Just as a reminder, last week we left off with Haman back at home after a terrible morning that turned into a terrible afternoon, and he's rehearsing everything that's happened. He's getting counsel from his friends and his wife. He needs a shower. He needs to reset himself. He didn't have breakfast that morning. It was a bad day. It was a no good, terrible, bad day that Haman had. And in the middle of it, it's amazing. There's very few Bible chapters that end in an interruption. And that's what happens here. There's an interruption. And verse 14 of chapter 6 says, "And while they were yet talking with him, came the king's chamberlains and hasted to bring Haman unto the banquet that Esther had prepared." And this would be the second banquet. And so right in the middle of that, this is all one day. He was going to wake up early that morning and talk about hanging Mordecai. All this happened in that one day. And he knew the banquet was today. At the same time that's going on, the king had not had a good night and hadn't slept. And he had found out that Mordecai saved his life. And he found out there was no recognition for him, which is what triggered all these events. But the king is also happy because he thinks he's solved the riddle to what Esther is carrying on about. Why she keeps coming to him and why she keeps saying, "I have an ask." And so that's where we're at when we get into chapter 7. But let me also point out one more thing. So keep something in chapter 7. Go to chapter 3. I want to refresh because it's been a month. And actually, I wasn't the one that taught this, but I've listened to it, and he was very accurate. In chapter 3, it's been a month since we've really understood why Haman wants to kill the Jews in the first place. And it's more than just Mordecai not bowing to him. It's more than that. In chapter 3, just let's look at verse number 8. Let's kind of reset and remind ourselves that situation. In chapter 3, verse number 8, "And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus, there's a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom." That's number one. He says, "Listen, King, first of all, there's these people and they're disorganized. They're not like all." And remember, he's got 120 provinces from India to Egypt. It's the largest empire in the world at this time. And he says, "Infested inside your provinces are a scattered people." That's the first issue that he's bringing to the king right now. Number two, he says, "And their laws are diverse from all the people." He's saying not only do we have this infestation, but they're peculiar. They're peculiar. They do weird things, King. If a fly drops into their cup, King, they just pick the fly out and they drink it. But King, if you touch what's in their cup, they throw the whole thing out. Because you are an infidel. You're not one of them, King. That's what Haman is saying here. These are a peculiar people and they're spread out. And then he goes on to say, "And their laws are diverse from the people." And then he says this, "Neither keep they the king's laws." So when the king's laws line up against the Torah or their laws or the laws that God gave them, they go with what God told them. And so he's saying, "Listen, we've got a problem. We've got these people and they're doing these three things. They're scattered, they're unorganized, they're peculiar, and they don't obey when what you say contradicts what they hear at church." That's what Haman is saying. "Therefore, it is not for the king's profit to suffer them." You're gaining nothing having these people here. Verse 9, "If it please the king, let it be written that they may be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hands of those that have the charge of the business and bring it to the king's treasury." So he's saying, I'll even pay for this to happen, for them to be annihilated and destroyed. "And the king took his ring from the hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the Jews' enemy. And the king said to Haman, the silver is given to thee. Now here's what that means. Keep your money. You've convinced me. The king doesn't profit from this. He says, the silver is given to thee. He goes, I'll accept it, but I'm giving it right back. I don't need it. You've convinced me this is a problem. He says, the silver is given to thee, the people also, to do with them as it seeth good to thee. Then were the king's scribes called, and on this day, and he says, basically he says, a year from now, we're going to execute this plan. So that's where we're at. That's what has got everyone worked up. And we've talked about these other things in the meantime. So here we are, chapter 7, verse number 1. I want you to make sure that you remember those things. Verse number 1, and we're just going to go through. There's 10 verses this morning. Let's read verse 1 and 2. So the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again unto the queen on the second day at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, Queen Esther? And it shall be granted thee. And what is thy request? And it shall be performed, even to the half of the kingdom. Now, when the king's saying this time, he's got a little more confidence that he knows the answer to the riddle. Because when a woman doesn't tell you exactly what she wants, it's a riddle. And he's like, I've solved it. I've figured it. I know what it is. I'm just waiting for it. And as soon as she asks for it, I'm going to say, it's already been done. Look at me. And he's not doing this because he loves her. He's doing this because he loves him. He loves himself. And he's like, I'm a gracious king. I've already addressed this. That's what he's saying here. Now picture this. So Haman, so the king is, he's going to go into the banquet. He's going to say this. And they walk in, since they walk in together. And he walks in, he's kind of like, Haman, bad day. You stink. Maybe not. He had a waste bucket from his daughter poured on him, according to the sages. Maybe that happened. The Bible doesn't say. We do know he's been to a stable. He's led someone around. He's worn some dirty clothes. He's worked all day. He had to do this himself. For a prime minister, we know that he's kind of disheveled, kind of smelly, kind of distraught looking. And so now get this. So the king, I want you to understand that two things can be true at the same time. The king can be very excited and anticipate going in because he knows what she's going to ask and he's going to deal with it. But he's also bothered by the look and smell and emotional state of his prime minister. Because obviously something is going on that he's not aware of. So we've got to keep this in mind as we introduce these verses. So things are going on, this attitude, this appearance, the smell of the prime minister. But at the same time, he's like, let's get to it. It's a banquet of wine. And also, what is pretty much taught is in the first banquet of wine was actually taking place while Esther was finishing her fast. So she really didn't participate in that. She hosted it. She prepared it. They ate. She served. And she made sure they were pleased. Here, her fast is over. So she's going to participate in this banquet. And we'll see that she actually does participate in this banquet. And so the king is looking forward to it because he, sleepless night, but had a great day because he solved the puzzle. But he's looking at his buddy, his prime minister. Let's keep reading. Verse number 3. Then Esther the queen answered and said, if I have found favor in thy sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we are sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. But if we had been sold for bondmen and bondwomen, I had held my tongue, although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage. Now this is some beautiful writing here. There's a lot going on. So not only do you need to understand when you're reading the Bible, more than one thing can be true at the same time. There's a whole lot more that's being said sometimes than what's actually being recorded. And so we need to break this down and understand what's really going on. It is believed that in this conversation, this is the first time, we can all agree, this is the first time that she's recognizing that she has a people that's slated to be destroyed. So we can conclude she's telling the king that she's a Jew. Okay, but not only that, because if you look at the Hebrew words here, which we have in English, not only does she tell the king that she's a Jew, she revealed to the king that she was from the lineage of King Saul. She's royalty in his eyes. This whole time, he thought his wife was an unlucky sex trafficked woman who was a commoner. That's what he thought. He needed to be fulfilled. We understand those verses from those chapters. And he picked her, thinking that she was a commoner, that she was nothing, a nobody, but she was really pretty, and she pleased and satisfied the king. He has just now found out she is not a commoner, she's a Jew. But not only is she a Jew, she's from the line of Saul. Well, how do we know that? Because the Bible says Mordecai is from the line of Saul, and the Bible also says that she's that Mordecai's her uncle. She's royalty. And if you look at when he starts calling her, what has been taught during up until this point is he would always, except in intimate moments when they were alone together, he would always address her through an interpreter. But from this point on, he doesn't. Okay, that's what the sages teach, that from this point, and you can actually see that when he starts answering it, because when he starts talking, like in verse number 5, it says, "And the king answered and said unto the Esther the queen." So it's like it's actually more direct, like he's not going through an interpreter anymore. He's actually acknowledging her status. But this changes his opinion about what's about to take place and what the ask is, because it's not just being asked by a commoner or a Jew. It's being asked by a Jew who's got some royalty. Now, we'll understand that here in a minute, why that's important. But again, verse number 4 says that she would have held her tongue if they were sold as slaves. Why would she have been silent if they were sold as slaves? Well, let me tell you, in Jewish business transactions, there is a law against fraud. And here's how they identified fraud. Any sale in which the profit exceeded more than 1/6 of the cost of the item, if you made more than 1/6 of the cost of the item, then that was fraud, and someone would speak up about it, okay? And it would be called out. Now, that applied to every transaction except land. You could actually make a pretty decent profit on land because land was given to you by God and you were supposed to keep it in your family, but if you did sell it, you better make some money on it. That's not God's law. That's what the Jewish cultural law said. Now, slaves in their law were considered land. So she's saying, because they were property, she's saying, if we were sold as slaves, because of it is fraud, but I couldn't say anything about it. I would have to stay silent. That's what she says in verse number 3, or in verse number 4. For we are sold, and I and my people to be destroyed, to be slain, to be perished. But had we been sold for bondmen or bondwomen, I had held my tongue. She's saying, if we were slaves, I couldn't say a thing because slaves are property. But you didn't sell us for slaves, you sold us for death. So now I'm not breaking the law or my people's law. I can now tell you that something bad is about to become of this, and I'm going to request that you don't do this transaction because this law doesn't apply. She says, we've been sold as slaves, again, I would have kept quiet. You were cheated in the transaction. It wasn't a good deal. The profit is not what you were told. It's not a good deal. But since we are not sold as slaves, but we are sold to be destroyed, then the laws of fraudulent business do not apply, king. And so obviously, she says, your adversary, look at the end of verse number 4, she says, your adversary was not concerned with the financial damage to the king that's resulting from this enormous loss. Now, what damage are we talking about? Well, there's a lot of damage. We're talking about tax revenue loss. We're talking about money, and she's saying that although the enemy could not countervail the king's damage, she's saying, king, you're getting damaged here. But more than that, other than financial, what other damage could you be referring to? In Zechariah chapter 2, verse 6, God says, "For I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven." Now, what God is saying there when he's talking about his people and he spread them as the four winds of the heaven, here's what God is saying. He's saying that it's impossible for the world to exist without wind. Because I've spread you like the four winds. What does the wind do? The wind carries away heat. The wind carries away humidity. We could not live in the world without wind. And what God is saying in Zechariah and what she's saying here is we cannot live in a world without Jews. There would be damage. And so she's saying, King, if you do this, just like if the four winds were gone, if you do this, if you remove the Jews from the entire world, there's going to be more damage than you understand. She's saying, you're the king. You're the king of the entire world. And she's saying, thank you for understanding this. She says, but because the Jews are spread out through your country, your entire land exists because of their contribution. And she says, if we were sold as slaves, the world would continue to exist. If we were sold as slaves in your world, King, we could still have a world. But if you remove the Jews from your world, King, the damage is going to be too much, and you're going to suffer tremendous loss. It makes you think about that. Every time the Jews are persecuted, think about the damage done to the world. I mean, even the Egyptian world, when they persecuted the Jews, there were plagues. Even in most of our recent history with World War II, when the Jews are persecuted, the world suffered. There was tremendous loss when Jews are persecuted. That's the damage that she's talking about here. That when the Jewish nation is persecuted, the world suffers. And she's saying, King, if it was just slavery, that's one thing. But your adversary doesn't consider all this. Verse number 5. Then the king Ahasuerus answered and said unto Esther the queen, Who is he and where is he that durst presume in his heart to do so? And Esther said, The adversary and enemy is the wicked Haman. Then Haman was afraid before the king and queen. Now this is very interesting because realize the king has been involved in this plot. In chapter 3, the king agreed to do this. If there were ever a thou art the man, it could have been right here. In fact, the Jewish sages say this, that Esther was willing to call out the king, that he was involved in it, and point to him, and as she was pointing to him, the Jews teach that an angel grabbed her arm and moved it and pointed it to Haman. The Bible doesn't say that. It's just interesting. But she has discernment here, and she doesn't say, Thou art the man. She recognizes her position. She recognizes her audience, and she says, It's Haman. He's the one. Now, what's interesting here is you got to ask yourself a question. Why, in chapter 3... We totally understand because of history, Haman hates the Jews. He's an enemy of the Jew. We looked at 1 Samuel chapter 15. We know his family. We know Haman hates the Jews. Why is the king so agreeable with destroying the Jews in chapter 3? Well, what the Bible doesn't teach us, but what history says, is that his stargazers, those that read the stars, told the king that your crown is going to land on the head of a Jew. This whole time, according to the sages here, this whole time in the king's life, he thought that meant violently, that his life was going to be taken from a Jew. But he has now found out, number one, that Mordecai is a Jew, which he knew. And remember last week, he didn't want to, but he gave Mordecai his crown. And his wife's a Jew, but not only is she just any Jew, she's a Jew from royalty. So the king is processing this. The king is processing that his plan to annihilate the Jews was called out. But he's also a master politician. If Haman comes to him and says, Hey, I'm going to pay you to eliminate the Jews. And he's like, Yeah, they're scattered. They don't obey. That sounds good. He's going along for it. He says, Keep your money. That way, you know, I'm not taking anything from it. Now he finds out his wife is a Jew. And he's like, what is going on? Who is this? How could this thing be? I mean, this guy's a master politician. And again, her intuition and her discernment, she goes right to Haman and she says, It's Haman. She says, Haman is the one. So again, the king consented. You know, thou art the man. That could have been said right there. And we would have gone, Oh yeah, yeah, that makes complete sense. But Esther's brilliant here. She's fasted and prayed. She's got this plan from God. She's executing this plan with patience and discernment. But still, there's wine at this, and the fact that, you know, he thought he had figured out what she wanted, Come to find out he was wrong with the riddle. He thought he had figured it out. He's not able to get that feather in his cap. It makes him mad. It makes him mad. It makes him mad that he's gone along with this plan. It makes him mad that what he thought was about to happen didn't happen. He's a king. I'm not a king, and I get mad when things happen that I don't want to happen, that I think should happen. He's very angry at this point. So he starts getting mad. Look at verse number 7. And the king, arising from the banquet of wine, in his wrath, went into the palace garden. So you got to remember, this is the culture. They're reclining when they eat. And according to chapter 1, you know, they had probably had a bunch of leftover gold cups. I'm sure the couches they reclined on were gold couches. I'm sure it looked amazing, right? And he gets up and he's like, everything that I thought is not right. And she just called out Haman, and he goes out into the garden. He's like, I need to walk it off. I need to cool down. And he storms out. Now, oddly enough, what history tells us is the place that he went, this palace garden, is the exact same place where Vashti, now the Bible doesn't say this, where Vashti died. The sages say that it was actually Haman that influenced him to kill Vashti. So now he's going, oh my goodness, this man Haman, who shows up to my wife's banquet, smelling, dirty. Now she's accusing him of this plan that he fooled me on, because you know he says it enough, he's going to believe it, that he was fooled on this plan. So this man has already convinced me to eliminate one of my wives, and now he tried to get me to kill my other wife. He's obviously coming for me next. That's what they think is going through his head right now. He is livid, wrath. And usually when you go out to cool down, when you come back, you're cooled down. We'll find out that didn't work. But let's keep reading verse number 7. So the king, arising from the banquet of wine in his wrath, went into the palace garden, and Haman stood up to make a request for his life. Now go back to verse number 6, because this says this. It says, then Haman was afraid before the king and queen. Here's why Haman was afraid before the king and queen. He hasn't said anything yet, but he's heard that she's not a commoner. He's heard she's a Jew. He's heard, according to the sages, she's a Jew from royal lineage. He's seen the king respond to that. In his eyes, he's most likely seen the king stop talking to his wife through an interpreter, even though they both knew the same language, and start directly talking to her. And he's processing all this, and he's a smart man. So he's afraid, says verse number 6. Said he was afraid before the king and queen. So he is, this is unbelievable. What's going on, he says in his mind. So when the king leaves, Haman stood up to make request for his life to Esther the queen. For he saw that there was evil determined against him by the king. So he knows this. And so I want you to imagine this situation. Esther is reclining because she's eating. The king is left, and he is visibly shaken and stumbling. And he comes up to her, and he's begging for her life. Now, this is amazing. And everyone takes the easy fruit. And everyone who teaches this and preaches this says this. All he wanted was a Jew to bow to him. He wanted Mordecai to bow to him. And now he's bound to Esther. And that's true. But no, 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 no. All God wanted was for Saul to eliminate the king Agag. And now here is Agag's descendant and Saul's descendant. And he's begging his life to Saul's descendant, to Esther. And she has the chance to end his life or give him mercy. Now that is a pretty amazing justice if you think about it. And yeah, I mean, it is a Jew now getting bowed to by, and yeah, and what they say about all he wanted for the, yeah, that's true. But it's way more beyond that. Way more beyond that. And so he's doing this. He is begging for his life. And I want you to understand this. And I don't want to offend anyone. And I don't, because what we read in verse number 8, we're going to read this one word called, and it says fallen. And this word fallen in Hebrew is this It's this repeated action. And I'm not trying to be crude or vulgar, but I want you to understand, Esther is reclining and he's begging and he's on her like this and he's begging and he's just begging and he's begging like this. I want you to understand that. And she's laying here reclined. Verse number 8. Then the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine. And Haman was fallen upon the bed whereon Esther was. So the king has no idea what has taken place from the time that he went out to cool off, but then was reminded of how bad Haman was with his first wife. And now he's thinking about how Haman wants to kill his second wife. And he comes in and he's seeing Haman repeatedly up and down falling on Esther. Get the picture? Then said the king, will he force the queen also before me in the house? The king misinterprets the situation, not as a man begging for his life, but as someone, and the word forced here is conquer and subdue. So he's saying, now, it's not good enough that you killed my first wife, even though he actually didn't. He just influenced the king to. But that's not how kings see things. So not only did you kill my first wife, and now you want to kill my second wife, because he's not really considering all the people of the Jews yet. We won't get into that until chapter 8. The king is very tunnel vision here. He's saying, before you want to kill my second wife, you're going to rape her? That's what he's saying. And he's had enough. He has had enough. And he says, then said the king, will he force the queen also before me in the house? As the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now, this is a traditional cultural thing that a criminal is not even worthy to see the king's face. A criminal is not worthy to even see the sun. That's what the Persians believe. You don't deserve to see the king. You don't deserve, and remember, you can't just approach the king, right? So this is consistent with their stupid laws. But they immediately hood Haman. Now, this is pretty interesting. They just cover him up. And then we go to verse number 9. And Harbona, one of the chamberlains, said before the king, behold also the gallows 50 cubits high, which Haman had made for Mordecai, who had spoken good for the king, standeth in the house of Haman. This is amazing. I always like to tell my kids when they're little, you don't have to tell everything you know. All right? I mean, you're not lying. You don't have to tell everything you know. Harboni, he's mentioned in chapter 1. He's a chamberlain. So there's 7 chamberlains, and what that usually means is you're on the king's duty for 24 hours. Everything the king needs for 24 hours, you're the guy. So he was on shift that day because he's mentioned in chapter 7, which also means he was probably the chamberlain in chapter 6, verse 14, that interrupted Haman and his friends, right? And so he has heard what they said about the Jews. Remember what they said in chapter 6? If he's from the seed of the Jews, and you begin to befall it, this is not going to end well. That's what they said. Well, Harboni most likely has heard all this, but you got to ask yourself, wow, Harboni, how do you know such specific things? I heard a rabbi tell this story. He says there was this blind man, and this blind man would go from house to house begging for money. And so you ask yourself, well, how did he go from house to house and door to door? Well, the blind man was led by a young boy. The young boy would take him from door to door to ask for money. One night, the blind man, before he pillowed his head that night, laid and he counted his coins, and he had 30 coins. When he woke up the next day, his coins were missing. They were gone, and he's disheveled, he's distraught, he's heartbroken, and he's crying, and he's weeping, and he just can't believe that he's lost his 30 coins, and the boy comes and sees him, and the boy feels sorry for him, and the boy, he says, oh, sir, I found your 30 coins. And the blind man grabs the boy and just beats him, just absolutely beats him. And the boy says, why are you beating me? I found your coins. I returned it. And he said, the only reason you would know there was 30 coins is if you were here when I counted them. And so he knew he was the one that stole them. So they're saying, what they're saying is Harboni was part of the deal. Harboni knew the dimensions because he was involved with Haman. He knew Haman's plan. Now, the reason why I say that, and you're like, okay, whatever. Well, in Purim feasts, you know, I was talking about that, how they boo Haman, and they boo his wife. Every year during this feast, the rabbi actually says, and for Harboni, good shall be done to him. That's what he says every year. The rabbi stands up and he says that. This guy is not a Jew, but he did a good thing here. Even though he knew the plan, he heard everything they said about the Jews and everything they said about the God of the Jews and how you can't defeat him. He saw the situation. He was a chamberlain. He was in the room where it happened. He saw that she was a Jew. He saw that she was from royalty. He saw the king recognize that. He saw the king get mad. He saw the king leave. He saw what Haman was actually trying to do. But he read the situation and it's like, well, the king's wrong on this one, but overall, it's just going to call him right. And lets him do it. And now he's like, you know what, though? We got to get Haman killed because otherwise Haman's going to say, well, he was part of it too. So he says, well, king, there's this gallows, and it's 50 cubits high. And it was for Mordecai. He didn't even have to say that part. You see, he's covering his back. But the Jewish people, even to this day, you can watch a Purim festival ceremony, again, it's chaos. There's several of them on YouTube. Absolutely, everyone's in a costume. It's chaos. But to this day, they recognize him because that's what he did. Let's go to verse 10, then we'll be done. Because I think this is amazing. I hope you understand these 10 verses. There's so much more going on. We could probably spend a month on these 10 verses. So they hang. Let me finish verse 9 because I love this. Then the king said, hang him thereon. If I wrote the Bible, I'd end it right there. It's just like, awesome. Is wrong. I mean, he misconcluded why he should hang him. He wasn't trying to do what the king thought. But the king's like, hang him. And I think that should be the end, but it's not. Because look at verse number 10. And this is amazing to me. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then was the king's wrath pacified. Who cares about the king? This is a story about Jewish people. Written for us today. Why do we care that the king was pacified? It seems odd to me that that's there. It seems very weird and kind of out of place. You know, why does it say that? I mean, okay, humanly speaking, the king never forgave Haman for persuading him to have Vashti executed. In addition, he was angry at Haman for plotting to kill a second wife. He was angry at Haman for what he thought was an assault on his wife. The king probably concluded he was next, that Haman would come after him. He's no fool on how royalty works. So, you know, he's probably happy that Haman was now hung. But this is more important. This is why it's recorded in the Bible. Because we can conclude that, right? I mean, it's the king's idea. We could have concluded that. We could have been like, oh, yeah, probably happy. Still doesn't address the issue that Esther wants. Esther wants her people to stop being annihilated. None of that has been addressed. None of that. At this point, you could almost say that the banquet is a failure. Except for the fact that Haman is dead. But the people are still slated to die. And we'll get into that in chapter 8. So why does it say the king's wrath was pacified? Because the king being at peace is the heart of Jewish people. What does a Jew say when they meet you? Shalom. What does that mean? Peace. What's another? They say, Shalom Aleichem. What does that mean? That means peace be upon you. How many wars have the Jews started? I mean, in modern history, have they started any wars? Has the country of Israel started any wars? No. No. They want peace. They want the world to be at peace. The world can never be at peace if they're persecuting the Jew. Again, you look at World War II, you look at all throughout history, there has been great persecution of the Jew, and the world around those situations and the world as a globe are in turmoil when Jews are persecuted. And here we see, this is a foreshadow. This tells the Jewish reader, you gotta remember, Esther's in a scroll. This is a scroll that they study and read because this is for their people, about their people. The story of Esther is the story of the Jewish nation. They say this. They say, well, Esther says that we were sold as, that if we would have been sold as slaves, well, that means because we sold Joseph as a slave. And the Jewish people say, well, this means this and this means that. And the story of Esther is the story of us. That's what the Jewish people say. Now, again, we're Christians, and we read the Bible as the Word of God, and the Old Testament is an example to us, and we can gain some things from it, how God loves His people and protects His people, and guess what? We are in the New Testament, adopted into His family, and we can apply so much of this to us. But to them, when they read this scroll, and the sages and the rabbis talk about this, when you get the end of chapter 7, it is great foreshadow, because the king is at peace. He's not a Jew. That means something good's about to happen. When persecution ends, the world is at peace. Will this world ever be at peace? Not until the world is at peace with the Jews. Amen. And will that ever happen until Jesus Christ comes back? No. There's so much richness in here. When they talk about stargazers looking and saying, oh, there's going to be a crown on the Jews, and he gets nervous and becomes an anti-Semite. You know what those stargazers were looking at? They were looking at stars for something else. There's so much history and real things wrapped up in this chapter and in this book. It's so deep. It's so amazing. Now, he got it wrong, the king did. He got it wrong because he got it wrong what he said the stargazers were looking at. He got it wrong because he hated the Jews. He got it wrong because he thought his crown was going to end up and being taken by force. And we read that Mordecai... And later on, again in chapter 8 and chapter 9, Mordecai is going to have another crown on. And it's all there. It's all there. He got it wrong about Haman and his wife. He got it wrong about Haman and Vashti. But what this tells us here at the very end of verse 10 is he's about to get it right. And next week, we'll start looking at that. Let's get ready for Big People Church.